Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, December 7th, 2025. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey. I'm your moderator for today. The share ID numbers for Friday, December 5th, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,010. That's 23,010. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,011. 23,011. This morning, A Vision for You presents Sponsoring with Emotional Sobriety. Step 12 states, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to compulsive overeaters and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Step 12 gives us a guarantee, a promise that if we take the first 11 steps, we will have a spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. When you've had a spiritual awakening, what are you supposed to do with it? Well, that's what Chapter 7, Working with Others, is all about. The Big Book states that we have recovered and have been given the power to help others. We can now sit down with another individual who has a problem similar to our own and convey with an understanding and a message that no one else can. Because of our experience, we can cross barriers of race, religion, and every other kind, and we can help and guide another in a very special and meaningful way. It becomes a bright spot of our lives. Many of us come into recovery believing that our biggest challenge is simply to stop the behavior of compulsive overeating. But as we grow, we discover that real freedom involves more than abstinence. It involves learning how to live, learning how to interact, to respond, and to relate to others with humility, balance, and serenity. This deeper stability is what we often call emotional sobriety. Sponsorship plays a vital role in that process. As sponsors, we learn how to show up for another person with compassion, with honesty, boundaries, and accountability. We learn how to listen without fixing, guide without controlling, and support without rescuing. As a result of practicing the principles in all our life, we are able to put principles first in our sponsoring rather than ego and personality. And in doing so, we discover that helping others is often the very thing that helps us grow the most. What lies at the heart of the sponsorship process is the authenticity of the relationship we build with our sponsees. If we are honest and ethical with them, respect their vulnerability and their trust in us, help them work through the steps, and model 12-step principles to the best of our abilities, we will have served them well. Joining us today to elaborate on this topic of sponsoring with emotional sobriety is John Kay, recovered compulsive overeater from Los Angeles. John is a loyal servant of Overeaters Anonymous, a beloved friend to A Vision for You, and it's always a great delight and with great appreciation that I welcome John to the line. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Leah. Wow. What an intro. I can just stop now and go, okay, what she said, let's take questions. But I won't. And it's so nice to have seen you at the convention, all the other people I saw at the convention. And thanks so much for letting me do this. So let me just start. I want to start by repeating something I said at the relapse workshop at the convention. I reminded everyone there that OA has no gurus, including myself, that we are all just fellow compulsive eaters, and that everything said by me, in fact, everything said by every speaker at that convention were opinions for people to take and consider. So these thoughts I'm going to talk about are opinions, but also from someone who's been in program for 43 years and abstinent for the last 29 of those. So, you know, we come into the world as the perfect little beings we were meant to be. However, we quickly change due to the various actions and events that happen to us. And those of us who grew up in the, you know, less than optimal households were affected even more severely. You see, we are the culmination of all of the stories that have been told to us about us. And these stories come from parents or other adults in our lives, siblings, classmates, teachers, partners, and especially society. And they can all add up to us feeling less than and worse about ourselves. And as a result, we begin to take on lifelong behaviors that we now need to change if we want to stay abstinent. And the big book calls these self-defeating behaviors character defects. Now, I believe these behaviors were and are coping mechanisms, defense mechanisms, or to use a more technical term, maladaptive behaviors. These ways of living served a purpose for us at one time in our life, but now they work against us. So many of these behaviors are rooted in ego or self-centeredness in one form or another. And the Big Book couldn't be any more explicit about this. These coping mechanisms were based mainly on the underlying feeling that we were not enough, that these behaviors were attempts to convince others and ourselves that we were enough. Now, those behaviors, besides being self-defeating, were also unnecessary because we are enough. We are the perfect little beings that came into the world, the people we were born to be, the people our higher power wants us to be. It's our job now to strip away all of those negative stories about ourselves that were, after all, told to us by others. Sadly, they were often adopted and reinforced by ourselves. And when we truly realize we are enough, we take a huge step down that road to emotional sobriety. You know, the effect of finding our true selves means we no longer need those old behaviors and can truly come to accept ourselves as human beings. You know, not perfect, but striving to be the best people we can be. You know, I find myself lately really feeling recovered. Now, it's easy to say recovered. It's another thing to genuinely feel you are recovered. And I was always reticent about using that word because even though I know I am recovered based on the definition used in the foreword to the first edition, I felt that word also encompasses all three aspects of the disease, physical, mental, and spiritual. And while I had achieved physical recovery, I felt there was a long road of work ahead before I feel recovered on an emotional, mental level. And the road was even longer to feeling truly recovered on a spiritual level. Well, today, you know, when I assess where I am, versus where I was earlier in my abstinence. I mean, even just as little as 5-7 years ago, I can see the emotional and spiritual growth. Now, I wanted to think I was at this point a long time ago, but you know, as I've always joked, we are all think we're more recovered than we actually are. And there are changes in me I couldn't have imagined. You know, negative people don't bother me anymore. I'm rarely worked up about anything. There may be things I don't like that annoy me, but they don't cause my blood pressure to rise. And there are no situations during the day that continue to vex me long after I've left them. Now, these things used to stress me and cause me hours of rumination, and they no longer have a hold on me. I don't hold on to resentments. I don't hold on to anger. I have no real fears outside the normal human fears. You know, put me in a cage with a lion. I'm going to have to take that back. But on the whole, I can see the changes in me, and as a result, I have watched the promises come true for me. And I think these changes in my outlook on life and others are a barometer of my emotional sobriety. And I think my experience mirrors what is spoken about in the spiritual experience when it says, quote, he finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. Well, there's two parts to that, my change and how it came about. And the most important word in that paragraph is reaction. It doesn't talk about my actions in life. It talks about my reactions to life. The vast majority of my actions in life are really reactions to other things happening in my life. And almost all of those things involve people, places, or things, all of which I've been taught I'm powerless over. You know, there's a power governing all of those things, but it's not me. There are many, many things in the world that I find frustrating, unfair, maddening. And if I were God, I'd take care of those things in a minute. But I'm not. An important lesson I had to learn was that in any of those situations, I don't have the big picture. You know, in looking back at my life, some of the things I thought were the worst things that ever happened to me at the time actually turned out to be the best things that happened to me. And I couldn't see that, though, because I couldn't see the future and how the dots connected from that bad thing happening to me to the good things happening later. And I think that's why the word only in the 11th step is the most important word for me in those steps, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. You know, and step three has finally come into focus for me. You know, I always had trouble with phrases like turn it over. You know, I couldn't connect with them. But in the AA 12 and 12, it talks about turning a key. And that morphed into a mental picture of a gate across a path. I didn't have to jealously guard that gate, which was using my will, wanting things to go the way I think they should. In fact, I had to do the opposite. I had to open that gate and step back and let the world go by, a world directed by a power greater than myself. In other words, I had to remove the blockage of self-will. Well, having truly taken that third step, I now have a deeper understanding of what the Big Book was trying to teach me all these years. And what it's talking about is the human response to life. You know, not just addicts, alcoholics, and compulsive eaters, but rather humans in general. And so much of it is wrapped up in ego, which is why the Big Book talks so much about it. You see, ego is bred into us, not taught to us. It was very important for our ancestors to think of themselves first, or they wouldn't survive. And we're all descended from them, and we have that DNA in us. And in a lot of ways, the Big Book is asking us to live differently than how our DNA would have us act. You know, it's about holding ourselves to a higher standard than the rest of society. But the reason we do this isn't to turn ourselves into Gandhi or cloistered monks, and it's certainly not so we can think of ourselves better than anybody else. We do it because if we don't, sooner or later, as it says in the Big Book, we'll the insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again, and with us to drink is to die. So the humorous irony in all this is that the Big Book is telling us we have to lose our ego for selfish reasons. This, however, is the good definition of the word selfish, as in to help ourselves. You know, jettisoning one's ego, accepting life on life's terms and people as they are is the embodiment of step three. And the key to real freedom, and most importantly, to emotional sobriety. Now, Bill Wilson first wrote about this concept in a letter to a friend in 1956. The letter was later published in the January 58 edition of the AA Grapevine under the title, The Next Frontier, Emotional Sobriety. And thus, emotional sobriety term was born. Now, in that letter, he says, quote, watch any AA member of 6 months working with a new 12-step case. If the case says to devil with you, the 12-stepper only smiles and turns to another case. He doesn't feel frustrated or rejected. If his next case responds and in turn starts to give love and attention to other alcoholics, yet gives none back to him, the sponsor is happy about it anyway. He doesn't feel rejected. Instead, he rejoices that his one-time prospect is sober and happy. He well knows that his happiness is a byproduct, the extra dividend of giving without any demand for return. So when we talk about sponsoring with emotional sobriety, what does that mean? Well, to me, it's about taking all those traits I spoke about and bringing them into the sponsor-sponsee relationship. You know, emotional sobriety is not about denying emotions, but about responding to them in a healthy and balanced way instead of being controlled by them. It means acknowledging feelings like anger or frustration or sadness without letting them dictate your behavior or using them as an excuse to act in a way that isn't helpful to others. To me, emotional sobriety means developing these four important traits. One, emotional stability. Not being thrown off center by every frustration or disappointment. Learning to feel your feelings without being overwhelmed by them. Two, developing a realistic relationship with yourself and others. It's about learning to be less controlling, but also less people-pleasing. It means accepting others as they are rather than trying to manage them. And then three, freedom from old emotional patterns. Learning to let go of resentment, self-pity, catastrophizing, and perfection. It means understanding the difference between responding and reacting. And finally, four, living a life based on your principles instead of your impulses. It means using all the spiritual tools of the program when emotions spike. It's about making choices aligned with our values, not our fears or frustrations. So what are the traits of someone who has achieved emotional sobriety? Well, I think they include patience, empathy, and most importantly, compassion. You know, I work with many people in program, not as a sponsor, but as someone that a lot of people reach out to, especially those either in or previously in relapse. And some of the stories I hear about people's sponsors is what spurred me to do this talk. I think sponsoring is one of the most important things we can do in program. You know, as I said, we give back to others that which was so freely given to us. And this is something I really try to do on a daily basis, because if it weren't for AA and OA, I'd have been dead and gone a long time ago. And since I'm not, and I was given a second chance, and then a third chance, it's my obligation to continue the chain of recovery by paying it forward. I don't think Bill and Bob wanted people to recover and then selfishly walk away from helping others. Now, the most important service I can give is being a good sponsor. Being a good sponsor, an effective sponsor, that can change the course of somebody's life. And if you do it right, you can help somebody who is miserable and who can't get out of the food and show them a better way of living as outlined in the steps in the big book. Now, one of the sponsor's most important jobs is modeling true recovery for their sponsees to see. Now, I can talk about all the lofty precepts of the program and how it changes your life, but if I'm then dictating to sponsees what they should do or how they should be living their lives, is that an example of emotional sobriety? Is chastising sponsees for slipping, or God forbid, firing them for slipping, leaving my ego on the shelf? If I dazzle them by reciting large tracts of the big book and then berate them for calling 5 minutes late, have I really reached the point of calling myself a recovered? Do I tell them how the program teaches us to give up control, but then instruct them on what they should or shouldn't eat? Do I say or intimate that if they're taking psychiatric medications that they're not abstinent or sober, even though AA specifically says no AA member should play doctor? So am I modeling the type of behavior that the book lays out for us? Am I modeling the attributes of emotional sobriety? Now, if there's part of the sponsor that feels superior to their sponsee and feels that the sponsee needs, you know, quote, guidance that the sponsee didn't ask for, isn't that the sponsor's ego having a need to feel that way? You know, sponsees may be newly abstinent or struggling, but it's important to not lose sight of an important fact. If they stumble, they shouldn't be treated like errant children. Remember, the main person that a sponsee slip hurts is them. Again, a sponsor who feels they are enough, that is happy with themselves, that has reached the point of emotional sobriety, doesn't need to do things like that. An important thing I'd like to mention about program is something that I think gets lost on people, the big picture. You know, we spend a lot of time studying the big book, page by page, paragraph by paragraph, even comma by comma sometimes. Now, this isn't a bad thing. I think it's a great practice that vision is spreading through all ways as a whole. However, every once in a while, it's important to pull back and look at the big picture of why we're all here. Now, I think the why concerns three things. One, we're here first and foremost to recover from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, specifically compulsive eating in our case. And that's the goal. That's the destination. And if you think of it as a destination on a map that we're trying to get to, it's important to remember that there are many roads to get to that goal, not just the one you're presently on. You know, sponsors can point others to a road better suited to help them reach their destination. Goal number two, well, that's to keep us out of the food by making our lives better. And our lives get better, not because the world will change, but we will. You know, the main goals are laid out in the Night Set Promises, but I think there's more than that. It's about living life without food, and one that allows us to be happy, joyous, and free as well. Or perhaps content and being at peace with yourselves, better described. Which leads to goal number three, which is being a good human being. You know, understanding that practice these principles in all our affairs not only leads us to being kinder and more compassionate toward others, but it also makes us feel even better about ourselves. You know, we realize we're becoming the best version of ourselves and the person our higher power wants us to be and is guiding us towards. Now, I hear many stories of people in program being treated poorly by their sponsors. Now, these sponsors aren't bad people. They have no ill intent. However, it's a totally human phenomenon that we sometimes harm people without even realizing it. And some of this goes back to what I just mentioned, remembering that the goal can be achieved in many ways. You know, people are so different in their histories, their temperament, and yes, even their food plans. You know, I spoke in my last special edition about how some people's stories are such that I don't have any trouble believing they're compulsive eaters. I have trouble believing they're still alive. I have trouble believing they're not permanently institutionalized based on some of the horrible trauma that they've experienced in their lives. You know, is it any wonder that they may have had more trouble getting and staying abstinent than any of us? And one of the most important things to do in the beginning is to have a sponsee tell you their story, not just their food story, but their life story. And this is so important because that knowledge will help you be flexible in helping sponsees find that correct road that works for them to get them to their destination. You know, you'll hear the phrase terminally unique batted around in program, and usually not in a flattering way. But we are all unique. And what will work for one person won't work for another. And the 12th step tells us to help as many people as we can, not just those who want to work the program exactly the same way that we do. It's so important to lose the idea that there's one cookie-cutter approach that'll work for everyone. You know, it's human nature to try and find simple answers to complex problems. And our disease is about as complex as you can get. And our job as sponsors, I believe, is first and foremost being an objective third party. Because we all suffer from a cunning, baffling, and powerful disease that can easily take someone committed to abstinence off in the wrong direction before they even know it. And this is where we can come in and help right the ship. But from the place of kindness and compassion that comes with emotional sobriety. The number one thing I think a sponsor needs to do is to leave their ego on the shelf. We all need to remember that we are not the disease. The disease is the disease. And the same is true for sponsees. They are not the disease. You know, there's an old church saying that says, hate the sin, but love the sinner. Now, I'm not equating anything with compulsive eating to sin. I'm just pointing out that many people in the world are able to separate a person's actions from the essence of the person they are. And those people don't have a disease that causes their thinking to get warped like we do. And it's important to find yourself, if you find yourself getting frustrated with a sponsee's actions, remember, this sponsee has a disease that they don't want and they didn't ask for. Or they wouldn't be in a way and asking for your help. The more you can do to tease the disease away from the person, the better. Well, one of my jobs as a sponsor is to gently ask a sponsee who may be doing something that's not helping their abstinence something like, okay, is this your idea? Or could it possibly be the disease's idea? You know, the more I can show a sponsee that we're working together against the disease rather than having a battle of wills, the better. The main thing that is needed is a good relationship between the sponsor and the sponsee. You know, it should be a relationship involving trust, non-judgment, and safety. And by safety, I mean the kind of environment where the sponsee will never fear being honest with the sponsor, especially about the food. See, the disease wants the sponsee to be dishonest when it comes to slipping, because then it's a little secret that can lead to more slipping. The best service you can be to someone is making them feel safe enough to tell you things that they might find embarrassing, like slipping. Now, many times when the relationship between a sponsor and a sponsee starts going south, the trouble is ego, the sponsor's ego. If a sponsor comes in with a here's what you do attitude, it's loaded with potential landmines. Of course, the sponsor wants to think they're helping, and they may very well do so. But by speaking about what worked for them, or perhaps others, it goes a lot further in getting the point across. You know, oftentimes, sponsee-sponsor clashes come from something called counter-transference. And this is where a sponsor starts seeing his or her sponsee as some kind of reflection of themselves. But our effectiveness as sponsors relies heavily on our objectivity. If we're affected emotionally by them in some way, chances are it isn't about them, it's about us. Again, if a sponsee slips, he or she is the only person affected by their choices. It's so important for a sponsor to know where they stop and the sponsee begins. Now, I have always told sponsees, hey, please be honest with me about your food, because if you slip, I promise you, I won't gain a pound. Some sponsors have the, you know, my way or the highway approach. You know, and yes, this is what worked for them, and it might have been successful for many of their friends. That group, however, is self-selected, which can give the false impression to them that their way is the way of working the program. But I wonder how many newcomers did they drive away by this insistence that there was only one way to work the program, their way. You know, it's also possible that those newcomers could have been driven off not by the message itself, but by the sponsor's way of carrying the message. Sometimes the message can be delivered in a kinder, more loving way and propose more suggestions than requirements. You know, it might make the difference between somebody embracing the program that might save their lives and one that pushes them away through its rigidity. Now, I'll hear people say, well, I sponsor the way I was sponsored. And I want to ask, are your abilities that limited that you can't deal with a sponsee who has different needs than you? Plus, what if the way you were sponsored wasn't the optimal way to sponsor, and now you're handing it down to another generation? To me, it comes down to just a few things. Is the sponsee staying absent? Are they happy? Do they continue from there to work on steps and read the big book? You know, if a sponsee can hear things spoken about gently by a truly caring sponsor, from a here's what I did standpoint, he or she can start to see this isn't coming from someone on high, but just another fellow eater to another. And for many people, sponsors and sponsees can be seen as on different levels in recovery, you know, with the sponsor up here and the sponsee down there. Now, there's no reason to come into the situation with that idea because it can affect the relationship. We're still just two compulsive eaters working the program. The key to me is the bond that can develop if a sponsee can see that you just really want to help them. If you develop that bond, there's almost nothing you can't say to that person that they won't at least consider, because they know you're coming at it from a place of love and service. And the main power of a sponsor-sponsee relationship is its ability to pierce the disease's defenses due to the sponsor's objectivity. You know, it's our job to point out that there's a really good chance that putting whiskey in that glass of milk is not going to keep them sober. You know, I tell my sponsees that I'm not the food police, but I am the honesty police. You know, if you tell me in June that you're not going to eat, you know, whatever, and then in September you talk about eating that food, I'm not going to give you a hard time about it, But I'll just ask, did you have some revelation between then and now that made you change your mind about eating that food? Or is it possible your disease is just trying to slowly insinuate itself back into your life? And one of the things I don't do anymore is tell people what they should or shouldn't eat. If they ask my opinion, I'll give it. But like most sponsors, I do not have a degree in nutrition. And just like it says no AA member should play doctor, no OA member should play nutritionist. You know, it drives me crazy when I hear people talk about the phrase entire abstinence. Well, what is that? Well, it's someone's definition of abstinence, which is fine for them. But thinking there's only one kind of abstinence called entire, it shows the immaturity of black and white thinking. And for some, it's a way to feel superior in comparison to those working that program differently. I had a friend tell me how her sponsor told her that because she used artificial sweeteners, which my friend does not have a problem with, that she wasn't recovered. Now I laugh and I told my friend, hey, anyone who tells somebody else that they're not recovered is not recovered. Going back to the big picture, we need to remember that we're in Overeaters Anonymous, not Sugar Anonymous, not White Flour Anonymous, not Eaters Anonymous. The main reason we avoid any food is because we think it might trigger a binge or relapse, not just to deprive ourselves, but what those foods are will be different for everybody. I can eat some foods my sponsees can't, and they can eat some that I can't, and that's fine. We're different people. Now, in my bad old days of being a lousy sponsor, my ego would tell me that I was judging them abstinent. And if they obviously didn't want it, if they were slipping. You know, I look back and realize there was no kindness or compassion for a suffering fellow when they failed to live up to my idea of surrender. Now, sponsoring with compassion is not about being squishy and letting being a people pleaser. You know, lines like, oh, well, relapse is part of recovery, or let's just move on, are tremendously empathetic views. But a sponsor's job sometimes involves being honest. And to me, if a sponsee slips, I'll say something like, yeah, it sure seems like you messed up here. The disease got past your defenses. And again, I always talk to sponsees about learning to externalize the disease. When something isn't working or a sponsee is planning on doing something a bit unusual with a food plan, I like to ask the sponsee, hey, is this you talking or is it the disease talking? And I might even have them write a little on that question. And if someone is having trouble staying in the food, you again need to not use the cookie cutter approach. If a person relapsing has reread step one 15 times, chances are the 16th one isn't going to be the one that does the trick. You know, think of the individual and be willing to think outside of the box on how you can help. You know, there's something people assume from the Big Book that I don't think is totally valid. You know, there's many phrases in the Big Book pertaining to recovery, like willing to go to any lengths, half measures avail us nothing, with all the desperation of drowning men. And I think the unspoken inference there is that if somebody does all of those things diligently, they will find abstinence. The thing is that for some people, they are diligently doing all those things and are still having trouble finding success. Well, there's no guarantee that all people will find recovery by doing all the things they're told to do in the Big Book. Now, there are some people who can't find abstinence that fall into a different category. There are the people who don't do the work. They don't listen to suggestions. They're hoping the abstinence fairy is just going to hit them on the head with her wand and require little or no effort on their part. Now, I have to admit, I don't have a lot of sympathy for someone not willing to do the work. The trouble is that a lot of people in program look at anyone who's having trouble staying abstinent as falling into that latter category, and it's not fair. We run a number of OA meetings each week called Compassionate Recovery from Relapse. The members in those meetings are the ones who did do everything they were told to do, but without success. And many of the people there have been coming to OA for years and had little success, often with hardline sponsors. And people jump to the conclusion that a sponsees are trying to play games with the food or aren't willing and committed to abstinence just because those people have trouble with a hardline approach. And that's another misconception I'd like to point out. again, a person not willing and committed to absence doesn't keep coming back for years despite failure. At the same time, being flexible means assessing what a sponsee needs and what approach to take. Some sponsees appreciate a more directive approach, but again, that should be their decision. And sometimes sponsees change. Someone at our meeting said recently, I needed a hardline sponsor when I started. But after a while, that approach stopped working, and I began to resent my sponsor. Again, flexibility is the key. It always bothers me a little when I hear of a sponsor firing a sponsee just because they slip. Now, I'll never know the whole story, only what I've heard, which is usually from the sponsee that was fired, so I'll reserve judgment on it. I'm just of the mind that letting a sponsee go because they relapsed comes down to my assessment of the situation. If I'm just frustrated at them not staying abstinent, then that's my counter-transference. That's my ego here. My guess is they're probably beating themselves up way more than anything I could do. And to let them go is just adding to their shame and guilt. You know, I think back to when Bill Wilson was letting guys sleep on his couch in his apartment there on Clinton Street in Brooklyn. I don't think he would have thrown someone out on the street for simply having a slip. You know, my guess is Dr. Bob wouldn't have banned someone from the Akron meeting just because they were having trouble staying sober. You know, my therapist happens to be a Presbyterian minister, and he often talks about this acronym WWJD, as in what would Jesus do? Well, I think we need an acronym WWBD. What would Bill do? And with regards to a relapse, here's another possible approach, something coming from Therapist 101. Sometimes the best way to deal with somebody's disease behavior is to ask them what they think went wrong and what they think will happen to not have it happen again. I think it goes a lot further than just doling out advice. A psychologist I know says it's nice to show a client how smart you are, but it's even better to show a client how smart they are. If sponsees are slipping, then yes, something's not working. And I think the slip can be a time for reflection on what might be going wrong and what could be done to not have it happen again. Now, on rare occasions, I have told the sponsee that while I'm willing to stick with them, maybe their continued relapsing is due to something missing in our relationship. You know, I think I'm a pretty good sponsor, but you know, I'm sure I don't click with some people. But still, moving on would be their choice, not mine. You know, in my business, it's a breach of professional ethics to let a client go before doing all you can to set them up with someone else. And I think the same should be true with 12-step programs. You know, the main aim of the Big Book is to help people find a power greater than themselves to help them with their problems. At the same time, it's not about abrogating one's responsibilities in that process. I always say my higher power is my partner in recovery, but not my servant. You'll hear others praise their higher power in helping them get abstinent. But it's important to remember that that higher power didn't come down and rip the binge food out of their hands either. They still had to do their part. But sadly, I think some people hear others talking about the higher power helping them and think that means that they just keep praying at some point and it'll suddenly be easy. And you know, so much of the Big Book is great, but how it's interpreted is so important. You know, the Big Book talks about selfishness, self-centeredness being the root of our problem, which is true. The trouble is that the word selfish is a very pejorative word and doesn't describe, I think, what the book is getting at. And it almost sounds like we're being scolded, and that can easily turn the Big Book into an authority figure. To me, the whole point of the steps is that it's a process that's going to make your life better. It's going to make you happier, to help you be a better person. It'll help you learn to accept yourself, accept your humanness, and dare I say, even like yourself. And a person who likes himself doesn't want to do self-destructive things like eating compulsively. Now, there are many places in the book where it's very easy to see some of the passages as directions, as things we need to change in ourselves. Imparting these things in this way almost seems as if people working the steps need to submit under threat of relapse. But I don't think that's what the steps in the Big Book are all about. It was saying to newly recovered alcoholics that staying sober is going to be infinitely harder if you don't work to change all of these traits that are mostly working against you. And the number one negative trait being the belief that you are the higher power instead of finding one that'll help you with your problem. It's easy to see why some people frame the steps as directions, because other people talk about the steps in that program that way. They frame them as the directions we need to do, have to follow, to be doing the program right. Well, I would ask, what exactly is right? What might be right for one person might be wrong for another. To me, that isn't showing sponsees and newcomers the enthusiasm of why they should want to do the steps, not have to do the steps. To me, a sponsor's greatest gift to a sponsee is being able to impart the wisdom of the big book, but in a way that the sponsee won't see this whole program as something they need to submit themselves to. You know, I like to talk about the big book as a guide to life and make sure sponsees understand what it says in the big picture. I don't think, and perhaps for some people this is going to sound like heresy, I don't think the big book should be read as a legal document that has to be followed exactly without accommodation for individual circumstances. Another thing I always advise is don't take things said at meetings as gospel, even if many people are saying the same things. You know, there are a lot of thoughts passed down from one person to another in program that are nowhere in the big book or the 12 to 12 or any other program literature. Now, I'll hear things like, well, since you slipped, you got to give up your sponsees. Well, where exactly is that written? I think making blanket rules for all sponsees is certainly an easy way to sponsor, but it doesn't recognize that all cases are unique. And that kind of thing is just one of the many kinds of punitive things handed down from one person to another that, in my opinion, are totally counterproductive. You know, there are things that someone came up with a long time ago and people have been saying to one another for years without considering the logic and the validity of them. And these punitive things add to the shame a person who slipped already feels. And for many of us, the amount of shame we felt from slipping was exponentially greater after we came to OA than before. I mean, think of the situation I just mentioned. Should someone who's been in program for many years, who had a small program, had a small problem for a limited time, have to drop their sponsees? I mean, I've heard stories of people saying their sponsor told them they had to do that, and their sponsees didn't want to let them do it. I mean, shouldn't that choice be left up to the sponsee or perhaps to their sponsees? Now, I would tell a sponsee that their first priority is getting back on track, but I'd leave it to them to decide where to take it from there. And I'd add they probably owe it to their sponsees to tell them about the situation and let those sponsees decide. But one last thing about being a sponsor, remember to take care of yourself as well. As they say on airplanes, put the mask over your own face first. If you don't take care to not get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, you're not going to be your best as a sponsor. You know, sometimes being a good sponsor, one coming at the relationship with emotional sobriety, can be difficult. In some ways, it causes us to have to retrain natural human responses. And when you find yourself stressed or resentful about a sponsee, it's important to step back and examine the situation. As the acceptance paragraph tells us, quote, when I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact in my life, unacceptable to me. And the program's shorthand on that being, what's my part in it? Now, at the top of my checklist is there a part of my ego involved here? And more accurately, what part of the situation is poking at my ego and causing me to want to act like Cartman from South Park and yell, you must respect my authority? Again, we need to find a way to remember the big picture. This is an adult that we're trying to help that has a disease they do not want. And that disease is going to, from time to time, try to guide them into making bad choices against our earnest and usually correct advice. It's important to remember that they will be the only one affected by any bad decision they make, even if the consequences of their actions are exactly what you predicted would happen. Remember, a sponsor with emotional sobriety doesn't say, I told you so, even if having to not do that means biting your lip until it bleeds. All joking aside, I need to remember something that was said to me once by my Al-Anon sponsor. He said, don't rob someone of the dignity of making their own mistakes. Sometimes, to keep from reacting in the wrong way, a sponsor might need to stop the conversation until they can find a way to communicate instead of lecture. You know, there's a mind-body connection, and when you get annoyed or stressed, it triggers a physical reaction, which can then add to more stress, setting up something of a feedback loop. Sometimes the best thing you can do as a sponsor is nothing. As that same Al-Anon sponsor used to say to me, don't just do something, stand there. And that ability to override that which is in many ways a natural reaction to upsetting circumstances is the essence of emotional sobriety. Again, emotional sobriety is not about denying emotions. It's about not being controlled by them. It means acknowledging feelings, but without letting them dictate your behavior or using them as an excuse to act in a way that's not helpful to your sponsees. In the end, it still goes back to the big picture and remembering what the goal is, to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Now, if a person is maintaining their abstinence, is happy with themselves and their lives, and is a good person, that's checking all the boxes I mentioned earlier, right? Well, if that person is achieving all those things and yet has never cracked open a big book, are they any less recovered? If they've never done the steps, are they any less recovered? Well, I'd say no. Now, I'd quickly follow that up with my recommendation that they read the big book and work the steps. And I would tell them it's a good idea to do that because it'll improve their lives immensely and help them understand their disease better, which may very well prevent a slip in the future. Remember, the big book is not the destination. It's a tool to make it easier to get to your destination. And the steps aren't the destination either. They're a way to make changes that'll help your life better and help you become the good human being your higher power wants you to be. Nor are meetings the destination, no matter how many you go to. The destination is recovery. And none of us gets to judge someone else's recovery based on our own barometer of success. We're just here to be of service to another compulsive eater and pass on what we were given. And that's the attitude that aligns with the concept of emotional sobriety. And in the end, I'll reiterate, being flexible is not about being squishy. It's about meeting people where they're at. Now, to wrap up, the bottom line of the 12th step is to carry the message to those who still suffer. To me, that means carrying the message to all who suffer, even if they do the program in an orthodox way. And we also don't give up on a person just because they're having a harder time getting abstinent than we did. I mean, we thank our higher power for making our way easier because, you know, there, but for the grace of God, go I. Now, I'll hear some people want to pull out that sentence from atop page 96, which says, quote, we find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. Now, I agree with that, but I believe that sentence is pointing toward newcomers who don't want to do the work, not people who are in the rooms struggling. Members who are struggling shouldn't be told they're not willing because they come back. And besides, who am I to make pronouncements about what's in another person's heart? You know, relapse isn't a moral failure. It's a signal. It's information. If it can be viewed with curiosity instead of condemnation, it can become a doorway to deeper healing. It's more information that can be used to adjust one's abstinence moving forward. Remember, sponsees, actually all people truly working this program, are doing courageous inner work. They're learning how to live without food to deal with emotion. And that's brave work, even when it feels messy. You know, breaking abstinence doesn't make a person bad. It means they're on a journey of recovery and learning and self-compassion. What matters most is not perfection, but the willingness to begin again one day, one meal, one moment at a time. Always responsibility pledge states, always to extend the hand and heart of OA to all who share my compulsion. For this, I am responsible. And to me, the key word there is all. I want to help all who share my compulsion, even if their recovery takes a different road than mine. Anyway, as I said in the beginning, everything I said here today is just my opinion. And all I'd like you to do is think about what I've said, consider my words, and then, as they always say, take what you want. Take what you want and leave the rest. Anyway, thanks for letting me share.
John, thank you so much for your beautiful and compelling presentation on such a vital topic. This is certainly a gem for the archives. John's presentation, share ID 23014, that's 23014. John's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so do stay tuned for that. And we will now transition to a question and answer segment. You can pose a question to John, one question per customer, please. By pressing star one to unmute, I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Sue L.
Sue L.
Elena C.
Elena.
Cindy B.
Kaneyeta. Cindy B.
Mary Jo.
Mary Jo.
Jamie J.
Who is J? I'm sorry.
Jamie J.
Jamie J. Thank you.
Jessica C.
Jessica C. Anyone else want to get in this group? Okay, I'll take that as a no. I have Sue L, Elena C, Hanayeta R, Cindy B, Mary Jo, Jamie J, and Jessica C. Please, one question per person. Let's begin with Sue L. Sue L, star one to unmute.
Thanks, Leah. Fantastic presentation, John. Thank you for all the information. Can you give us some factors or maybe point us to some resources that would help us differentiate between being a squishy sponsor and being a compassionate, effective sponsor? Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Well, that's a good idea. That's a good question. I know there's a couple of really good meetings that they get together and talk about this on a weekly basis. There's a group called SES, Emotional Sobriety, it's OA group that meets, and they have a sponsorship meeting every Saturday night. I'm trying to think of explain it. It's 5 o'clock Pacific, 7 Central, and 8 Eastern, where people bat around what are the different ways to help people, because there are so many ways. And again, I'm one person's view, and I can give you some of the ideas, which I sort of just did. But there are other ways. And the thing I really try to really point out is that every situation is different. And so it's good to come into a situation saying, hey, I've got a sponsee who's doing this, this, or that, or I'm having trouble with this, this, or that. Is anybody have any ideas on what might work better? You know, I think that's the most important thing you can do. And again, just keeping your eye on, we're just here to do service. And sometimes, like I said, it can be frustrating, but again, we just need to remember that we're just supposed to help here. If they have a problem, it's not going to affect us. Anyway, just some thoughts.
Thank you, Sue L. Elena C., your turn.
Good morning. Good morning, Leah, for your service. Thank you, John, for the beautiful presentation. I'm sorry, I have some dogs here. my question is, what do you do, John, when a sponsee relapses over and over and over and over and over again?
Mm. Well, and that is the question, you know, trying to help them pull apart, you know, is this, you know, are there things I can change, you know? And, you know, even sometimes just saying, you know, I always love to quote, there's a great quote from the bottom of page 450 and top of page 451. It says something to the effect of the tides of life flow endlessly for better or worse, for good or bad. I can't allow my sobriety to become dependent on that. In other words, you know, if I have sponsee, and I've had sponsees say, you know, this thing happened to me and it was really bad and it caused me to go eat. It's why I ate. And I'll say, no, you ate because you're a compulsive eater. You know, I mean, whatever they mention as a cause may be totally valid and bad, but I tell them at the same time, when this bad thing happened, you didn't think of, you know, you didn't think of placing a bet on a horse, right? Well, if I was a sponsor in Gamblers Anonymous, I can guarantee you sponsors there have heard that. You know, it's been said for many years, you know, food isn't the problem, it's the solution. And so trying to maybe do some writing on it, are my expectations valid, you know? And is that such an important thing? I spoke about that at the convention, that expectations can make or break. Okay, so I'll tell you a quick thing, and then I don't want to hold up too much. When I was having trouble getting my abstinence back, again, I was in relapse for 14 years. I got really involved, and every Monday I would start, and by about Thursday it would fall apart over and over and over. And I had these wonderful sponsors who would say wonderful things and be supportive and maybe have read things out of the big book and everything, but I kept failing over and over and over. Finally, I got this sponsor. His name was Ward. And he sat me down. He says, okay, here's the situation. You're in your first 30 days of abstinence. It's going to suck. Now, the reality was it didn't all suck, but most of the days it didn't. It was okay. And when it didn't, I felt, okay, I'm ahead of the game. And when it did suck, I'd be like, oh, that's what Ward told me. I mean, it was all about the expectations. And I like to tell people all the time that, you know, it's in the beginning, it is hard. And I think this should be, you know, propagated a lot more, that in the beginning, it could be really hard. I think for those of us who have a long-term abstinence, if our day-to-day abstinence was the way it was in my first month, I probably wouldn't keep doing it. I'm not a masochist, but it doesn't. And to really make sure we pass on the message, it gets easier. It gets easier as you go along. But to get to the place where it's easy, you got to go through the place where it's hard first. And that sometimes stinks. But like I said, maybe it's about doing some writing. Well, what am I expecting? Am I expecting it to be easy? And what kinds of systems have I put in place? You know, if you don't have plans for certain situations, it's hard to make them up on the fly, you know, when you're hit. So trying to find all the things that have caused problems and see if you can find systems around them. That's the basic thing I'd say.
Thank you, Elena C., for your question. Hanayete R., your turn.
Thank you. Thank you, Leia, for your service. And John, thank you. You are such a fantastic speaker. I love listening to you. So you had mentioned that people would say, okay, so you lost your abstinence, so now you have to get rid of all your sponsees. And it does not say that anywhere that I've seen either. But what do you do about that? I mean, I've heard that, you know, call your sponsees and tell them what's happened and if they still want you to be their sponsor. Or, I mean, how do you handle that situation then? And especially when they go back on, you know, like pretty much right away. If they stay out, you know, what is the difference and what are your opinions on all of those things?
Well, yeah, I think it was sort of what I said. I absolutely agree with you that if a sponsee has a slip and they get back on, they at least owe it to their sponsees to let them know what the situation is. And then let them make the decision. They shouldn't feel bad if a sponsee says, you know, I think right now you should work on yourself. I'll get another sponsor, you know. And I really, too, try to make sure they understand that job number one is staying abstinent, but I really, there's so many things that are you hear batted around in meetings constantly. And one of the problems we have is so many of us have mostly the same ideas about program. It can become an echo chamber sometimes. And you'll hear that kind of thing about get rid of your sponsors. And you know, somebody said that a long time ago, and people have been just following it ever since. But I do say to sponsees, you know, hey, you know, staying absent right now has got to be job one, you know. And if having a bunch of sponsees is going to cut into your ability to be working on yourself, then, you know, it goes back to that thing I said earlier that you got to put the mask over your own face first. But again, I'm such a believer in that we should not infantilize people and treat them like they're not adults and that they don't have plenty of their own abilities to see a situation and make a decision. And so I'm a big believer. I'll give an opinion sometimes about things, but then the sponsee gets to decide how they want to do it. Anyway, that's my thoughts.
Thank you. Coming yet to R. Next up, Cindy B.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, this is Cindy from Boston. John, thanks so much. I really appreciated your share. You know, I've been in OA since 1984, and I've had lots of sponsors, and I've sponsored other people, but it's just been recently in the last year that I got my first Vision for You sponsor, and she was very much exactly what you've just described. I just took me through the steps in such a beautiful, gentle way. And it's been months now that I've completed, and I still don't have a sponsee. And I've sponsored before, but I don't know exactly that I can follow what she just did with me because I'm not really sure I understand it all. It was just amazing. And I'm wondering if you could give me any advice on how to approach this because I've never been so fearful about sponsoring someone before. Do you have any advice for that?
Yeah, sure. I always say, first of all, the one pushback I get the most from sponsees is when I tell them they got to start sponsoring. Oh my God, no, I'm going to screw up somebody's life. Oh my God, I'm going to do this and that. And, you know, well, one of the things I tell them is, and I used to do this, I had a sponsor, Carl, for the longest, many, many years. And I would tell a sponsee, okay, if you have something you're not sure of with a sponsee, tell them you'll call them back and call me and ask me, and maybe I'll have an answer for you. And if I don't, I'm going to call Carl, and Carl may have an answer. And if Carl doesn't have an answer, Jack S., who's his sponsor, will may have an answer. If Jack doesn't, he'll call Terrell, and Terrell will then call Natalie, and Natalie would call God. God would pick up for Natalie. The point being is you don't have to feel like you got to do those things. One of the most impressive things to me was I was going through something. I don't remember, you know, I think it was when I was dating and I was just having some problems, and I'm on this phone with Carl going, what's with women? I don't get this. And he listens to me for a few minutes and then he goes, John, you know, I'm a gay man who hasn't been in a relationship for 5 years. So I'm probably the last person you should ask. And I so appreciated that he didn't feel like he had to have all the answers, that he was able to say, hey, call Jack S. He's my sponsor. He's been married for a long time. He can help you. The point being is don't feel like you have to have all the answers. And as to working through the steps, I mean, I just like, you know, when I haven't done it in a while because most of my sponsors are long term, but just sort of going through the book and reading it, either reading it together one by one or having somebody read a page or two and then write on what it said and talk about it and move on. But then also, you know, just, I mean, I know some people say, oh, just take people through the steps and that's it. But to me, I mean, I think the sponsor is there as a resource ongoing, you know, and everybody can decide what that means. I have this sponsee that calls me once a day, like clockwork. I've others who only call one or two times a week, and I tell them whatever you want to do, and just know that if the stuff hits the fan, I'm here, call me immediately. And so don't feel that you have all the answers. You know, you don't, All you're doing is helping them read a book that you didn't write. So you can't do it wrong if you just go through that book and talk about it and talk about what it means to you. Because everybody has different feelings about what certain sections of the book mean. And damn, I keep saying that they keep putting new pages in there. Because I went back recently and I grabbed my first big book that I had. I was telling somebody the other day, it's a battered up big book with a big coffee stain on the front, which I just think is so apropos. And I opened it and I was reading and I was looking at the things I highlighted, and they're totally different from what I would highlight today, you know? But that's because we keep reading the book with new eyes and from a different place of recovery. And so don't feel like you're going to do it wrong. As long as you're working and reading the big book stuff, you know, I don't think you can go wrong. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Cindy B. Mary Jo, your turn. Star one to unmute.
Good morning, John. Thank you again for sharing all your insights. This is Mary Jo. Enjoying for the first time in many, many years being in recovery and open to learning what it means, you know, to just be my best self. And for the first time, I feel like I'm getting ready to be a sponsor. And that previous question was mine, was like, and I'm not so much fearful is I am just kind of in, you answered everything. So basically my question then would be, is there a specific way to start sponsoring, you know, I don't know. Go ahead, John. Just expand on that last question. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Jo. I think this is Mary Jo, who is part of our relapse from compassionate recovery meeting. Again, you know, one of the things I said is, to me, the absolute basis and the thing that's going to make it or break it is the relationship. And becoming, and one of the things I got told by Carl years ago, and he was right, I was such a people pleaser. People would ask me to be a sponsor, and I'd be, yep, okay, yep. And Carl said, because I just had some problems, and Carl said, look, it's fine to not say yes or no. Say, let's sit and let's have a talk. And this way you can get to know the sponsee, and the sponsee can get to know you, and you can talk about maybe how you work the program, and you can get to talk to them. And to me, that should be a good jumping off before you just say, okay, let's get this going. Because then this way the sponsee can say, yeah, you know, I don't want to sort of work it that way. And there should be no ego of, okay, sure, no problem. I think, again, the one thing I think is so important is hearing their story, finding out what brought them here. Not just the food, but is there other stuff? Because, you know, you can have sponsors who are compulsive eaters. They had something happen, but they grew up in these storybook childhoods where everything was great, everything was wonderful. Somewhere along the way, they got off the beam, and now they're compulsive eaters. But then they try to start sponsoring somebody who's had really horrible trauma growing up, you know, growing up an alcoholic household, or, you know, even on the streets sometimes, and they cannot understand why that sponsor is getting it the way they did. And the more you can just sort of be able to put yourself in their shoes and to be kind and loving and, you know, just keep, you know, being willing to ask questions, just making sure people know you're just there to try and help. And then again, I don't want you to think I'm saying, oh, we got to be lovey dovey and, you know, well, our job is to be honest. And if we see something that if we're objective third parties, we're going to see some things that they can't, just like, you know, I can see things my sponsees can't, and my sponsor could see things I can't. And that's what the great thing about working together with somebody is that we can do that. I'm a huge believer in the concept of God as he expresses himself through other human beings, you know, God, myself, and another human being. So I would just say, don't jump right in. Say, let's talk. Let's talk and have a conversation, maybe more than once before you decide, yeah, this is I think I can help you, or gee, like, for whatever reason, I don't think I'm going to be the right sponsor for you, you know, but make sure they understand it's about you, not them. So I don't know if that helps.
Thank you, Mary Jo, for your question. Next question from Jamie J. Star one to unmute.
Good morning. My name is Jamie J. And can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. I did come in late to the meeting, and let me tell you, I've never been on a live Vision for You meeting. I've always listened just to the recordings, and this is actually I just woke up and thought I'm going to get on, and it's actually been many, many years, since I've been in OA. This talk, John, was for me. I'm not in recovery right now. I don't know whether to say that I'm,
Jamie, yes.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you're here. So glad you're here. This is an opportunity for questions only. So if you have a question for John in the interest of time, please.
Okay, well, see, I think that response right there is actually something he talked about today, allowing me to get this out like the other questioners were allowed to get a few things out would be nice, especially for someone who's not recovered. And so that's why I think that this meeting was extremely important, because this is the kind of person sponsor I need. So I would say listen to the meeting again for that response right there, because that would make me want to hang up because I didn't even get to talk for 30 seconds. You know what I'm saying? So my question, I mean, seriously, that was a good example. So my question is, and you may have answered it, but I'm just so glad for the grace to be able to speak. Is what do I ask? What question do I ask a sponsor to get the kind of sponsor you've described today who has grace and patience? That's my question.
Thanks, Jeannie. Thanks. Well, I wish I could say there was one question that'll give you the answer, but it's more about being willing to sit down and have a talk and have a back and forth so you get to know what kind of sponsor they are. And again, there's no harm, no foul if for whatever reason it's not going to work well. I've been fired by sponsees, but I don't take it personally. I know it's just not the right click, you know? And you may find we have a number of these meetings now. They're OA meetings. There's nothing different about them, but they're what we call compassionate recovery from relapse. So we have one today at 9 o'clock my time, noon East Coast time, and then we have them on Monday and Wednesday. And if you're interested, they're in the OA. They're on the OA list, and especially if you put in this place where you could say, show me just the relapse meetings. And we have a wonderful community there, and we're all sort of kind and loving. And, you know, one of the things I hear is them saying that, Jesus, first place I felt like I could be honest. I don't have to feel like I'm being, you know, judged in some way. And it's, you know, there are misconceptions that come up, and they're a little frustrating to me because I've been around off and on Vision for a long time, been to every Vision convention, including Virginia Beach. there are wonderful, wonderful people in Vision. There are people who are kind and loving and who are doing everything and they're helping sponsees. But I've heard people say, oh, God, I'll never speak on a Vision meeting because I'm afraid I'm going to be judged. And they shouldn't feel that way, and there's no reason for them. They're sort of, you know, projecting that on. But the one thing I hear about our meetings is people feel, oh, yeah, I can talk about anything, because one of the things about the meeting we say is everybody here has either been in or is in relapse. And so you don't have to feel like any of us are going to sit on high from above. So I suggest you maybe think about that. We have we have a community, we have a phone list, and we tell people to, you know, call each other, talk about things, you know, don't feel like anybody's going to be judged. You may be face down in the food, but maybe you'll talk to somebody who'll say what you need to hear, you know. Anyway, I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for your question, Jamie J. Jessica C., your turn.
Hi, Leah. Thank you so much. Jessica C., recovered in Ontario, Canada. John, I really appreciated the kindness and compassion in your message, and I feel like I can take a lot of what you said and apply it to any relationship. So my question is I ask my sponsees when I start working with them to be on a weighed and measured food plan and to commit their food to me when they're working through the steps. And I find, especially with newcomers, they balk at this and they often disappear. And sometimes I wonder about how effective that approach is. So I sort of struggle with, like, this is a serious problem. Compulsive eating is a serious problem. We still have to eat. We need clarity around food. And this requires a new design for living. But I wonder about the rate at which I sort of lose sponsees at this point and if that's an effective approach or not. So I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, again, at least in OA, as I've been in HAL, when there's FA and all these other things where there's a sort of requirement to weigh and measure, I always talk about that, you know. Well, I'll say something that's going to probably sound like heresy. Hopefully, it won't be. A long time, 44 now years of sobriety, I believe the Big Book is dead on, bullseye arrow for alcoholism and addiction, but that it misses the food by just a little. Not enough that it's going to not work, but we have to work a little to get it to that place. Because alcohol and drugs are binary diseases. You're either drinking or you're not. I've never been in an AA meeting where somebody asked me what my alcohol plan is. Do you drink wine? But food is a spectrum disease. And as a result, we have different needs. We have different levels of it. You know, I always talk about my friend Roberta, who can eat all foods moderately, and God bless her, wish I could. But I also know she's not lying about it. She just happens to have a different level of a disease than I did. And so to me, I don't think weighing and measuring is really in any way congruent with work on the steps. I think being abstinent is. I'm a huge believer, you know, that, you know, being abstinent is, I mean, you know, it's sort of like, my wife's a psychologist, and she says she will not work with an active alcoholic because it's just a waste of their money and a waste of her time, that they have to have it down before the real growth can happen. But what's down for one person might not be down for another. And so, I mean, you know, if weighing and measuring works for you, it's great, but maybe it doesn't work for others. And it's about being honest. You know, and if they can say, I can do this without actually weighing and measuring, then that's fine. Everybody has to figure that out for themselves. When I'm going to do a relapse workshop at the birthday party in January, by the way, that's a little plug, birthday party, Los Angeles, Martin Luther King weekend. I talk about there, I believe that there's almost like different concentric circles of what's the outer one is Roberta. She can eat all foods moderately. I'm not in that list. But if you move down one, red light, yellow light, green light list, that works for me. Other people need to call in their food to their sponsor. Others need to weigh and measure, and you have to figure out where your line is, where what it is, what level of this is going to be needed to keep you abstinent, and realize that your disease is going to tell you it's less than you really should do. So I'll just say I don't think weighing and measuring is works for everybody. I weighed and measured perfectly for, I don't know, a number of years, and I just got to the point now where I don't. But I needed to in the beginning, and now I don't. But everybody, I don't think that should be contingent on working the steps. It's just my opinion, absolute opinion.
Thank you, Jessica C., for your question. We have time for one, perhaps two more questions. Anyone else would like to ask?
Hi, Andrea in Ohio.
Why? From Philadelphia.
P-P-P-P.
Margaret B., Georgia.
Ohio. Who's in Ohio?
Andrea in Ohio.
Diana Y., Philadelphia.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Let's go with Pete B. and Andrea. Go ahead, Pete, please. Pete B., star one to unmute.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Leia, for your service. John, thank you for your presentation. It was well thought out, articulate, and deep and heavy, and appreciate that. My question is, oftentimes you'll hear people emphasize the adoption or utilization of the tools of recovery as a requirement for recovery and a requirement for being a sponsee or a good member of the Fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous. Can you talk about that versus the steps or the utilization of the tools as something that's necessary in order to recover?
Yeah, sure. For those who don't know, I used to be a stand-up comic, and I could be really snarky. And one of the jokes I always say is, my God, how does anybody get sober in AA? They have no tools. Now, I can tell you that I think the tools are a good adjunct. I think they're mainly a good adjunct for the first three steps to work on, you know, getting some habits and getting some things to work. But I don't think they're a requirement as such. There's nowhere, obviously, no tools in the – I mean, there's no tool list in the big book. I think a lot of them are very good, helpful hints, but there's nothing that says you have to do any of them. I believe almost all of them, just like the program, are there to help you. But maybe for some, it's just not going to work. Some people, for many years, I was like pulling teeth to get me to do writing. You know, now I've changed my view on it. And maybe some of it was having people sort of push me to do writing. You know, Carl used to make me write longhand. Just kill me. I am just no good writing longhand. But yeah, I don't think the tools are something that's been came up with from OA World Service, from a bunch of compulsive eaters sitting around. And I don't know. Okay, this is going to sound, I don't know how it's going to sound. I believe this is a God-given program. I really do. You know, I don't spend a lot of time going into it, but you can't tell me a stockbroker in New York and a proctologist in Akron somehow get together to make this thing that people with doctorates in psychology go, my God, this is brilliant. And, you know, so I believe it came from somewhere. And I believe tools came from, you know, a group of eaters in Albuquerque. Anyway, so I think they're good, but I don't think they're in any way a requirement.
Thank you, Pete, for the question. And our final question comes from Andrea from Ohio. Andrea, your question, please. Andrea, star one to unmute.
Sorry about that. Thank you, John. That was very helpful to me to hear that. I've been coming to this meeting off and on for a lot of years, and one of the reasons I leave oftentimes is I find that I've encountered plenty of controlling sponsors. And I guess there's a little resentment there, but I'm here today, so that's all that matters. Has it been your experience that doing the weighed and measured food plan can actually trigger some people, like be part of their disease, and that continually trying to return back to that way is part of their disease?
Mm. Yeah, well, that's a good question. I do believe for some people that is a problem. Now, I have sponsees who, you know, I was in a weight and measure food plan program for a number of years, and it worked until it didn't. And part of it is it became an authority figure to me. And sooner or later, if you have, you know, if you're seeing something as an authority figure, you're going to start rebelling against it. Now, and for some people, it brings back dieting PTSD, let's say. And it's again, a lot of this has to do with the person's background. I know people who said one of the reasons that they had such trouble with hardcore, hardline sponsors is it reminded them of their father. And they did not do well with their father. And so, yeah, I believe it's a matter of figuring out what's going to work. I had a sponsee I worked with for years and just couldn't pull it together. And he ended up going to Gratiate Anonymous, and now this is what works for him. And I don't begrudge that at all. I think I would, like I did with the other programs, start to rebel against it. And then again, I think about the fact that like I eat the same breakfast. I've eaten the same breakfast for I don't know how many years, except when I'm on the road. And it's grape nuts. I happen to like grape nuts. And I have a little container I use. I go, boop, I put it in a container, bam, I put it in. I don't have to think about how much it is. But that's a choice I'm making. It's nothing that's being imposed on me. Any of these things that are done, and also to go back to what Pete said about tools, it's all about what's going to help you. You know, it's what's going to help you and not see it as something imposed on you. You've got to take all of these things on. And if I can make one thing, it's that I tell this quick story and I'll end in a second. And by the way, if there's anybody who has other questions, if you want to come on our meeting at 9 Pacific and noon Eastern, I'm more than willing to keep answering questions. When I was in that other program, they used to have this mantra that they would say, and it was, we eat three meals daily, weighed and measured, nothing in between except sugar-free soda, no calorie beverages, and sugar-free gum, right? And that was sort of what they said. And I had been in OA, I went there, I did well for a while, and it didn't start to work, so I came back to OA. And one day I heard this really great old-timer from the Valley named Ray. And Ray would get up and say, today I eat what I want, when I want, as much as I want, if I'm willing to pay the price. And today I am not willing to pay the price. So I eat three meals daily, weighed and measured, nothing in between except sugar-free soda, no-calorie beverages, and sugar-free gum. In other words, Ray was saying the same thing that program did, except Ray was using Ray's food plan, not someone else's food plan. And I think all of these things have to be things that people are willing to embrace, or else sooner or later you're going to start rebelling against it, you know? And that's not... You know, I don't think that's what it's about. If you feel forced into doing anything, and, you know, and I talk about that with food plans too. You know, if you're doing something because you're told you have to, or you know, even if society says this is my healthy plan, and you have any kind of resentment, it's only gonna have a time limit because you're only going to be willing to do that for so long. The whole idea is to embrace recovery. I want to go to meetings. I want steps. I want to eat the way I do, not because I have to. You know, I don't know if that makes any sense, but I thought I'd mention, and like I said, anybody who wants the meeting in a couple hours, I can answer other questions. I know we have time to go, so I'll hand it back to Leah.
Thank you, Andrea, for your question. Thanks to all who posed questions this morning. And, of course, thank you so much, John, for your outstanding and helpful presentation this morning. Really beautiful. Thank you so much. Share ID for today's presentation, 23,014. That's 23014. And we're going to close now from page 164. It's found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.